With me on the podcast this week is Lara Fatah from the Seed Organization. Lara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So we're going to get directly into the questions because I have quite a bunch of them for you to answer for me if you can.
Okay.
So starting off, what is Seed? What is the Seed Organization?
Well, Seed Foundation is a development NGO and we're based in Erbil, but we work in Duhok and Sulaymaniyah as well.
Okay. And why was it started?
Seed was co-founded in 2014 by Sherikram Talabani and Tanya Gilikhelani, and it was founded to promote social, educational, and economic development, hence the name Seed. But as the ISIS crisis unfolded over that summer, there was a need to focus more directly on crisis response project, but still within the same ethos of focusing on educational and economic development.
So I've looked on the website, I've looked at Seed's social media, and there's a lot of things that you're doing, but what is the main mission statement? What is the main thing that is driving the foundation forward?
So at Seed, our mission is to protect, empower, and support the recovery of survivors of violence and others at risk. And we're committed to delivering quality and holistic approaches. We combine a mix of international expertise and local know-how so that we achieve the best results possible for our clients and wider Kurdistan and Iraq. We do this working through four main areas. One is through delivering comprehensive service delivery of mental health and psychosocial support services. This includes doing case management, offering mental health support, legal services, as well as psychosocial support activities. The second way we do this is by strengthening capacity of service providers through education, training, and capacity building programs. And that can be ourselves as NGO service providers, and we also work with some government institutions as well, training them and other NGOs. The third way we do this is we promote policy and social change to strengthen the rights of and protections for vulnerable groups and individuals. And then the fourth way we're working is for the protection and recovery of survivors of trafficking. And one of the ways we do this is through our shelter for victims of trafficking.
We work on a broad variety
of things, and we work hard to make a difference.
Yeah, it's really a lot to unpack, but I wanna know. You mentioned programs. What kind of programs does Seed work on?
Our programs tend to work across those four areas that I mentioned. Some of them will work on three of them, so they might do service delivery. They might do strengthening of capacity. There may be a policy aspect to it, or some of them might be focused just on training. So it depends on the different grants we have. But for example, one of our biggest programs is by PRM, and a lot of our service delivery side of that program is up in Duhok, doing case management services, providing mental health support. We do psychosocial support group activities in the camps. And these can have a variety of educational aspects to them, well-being aspects, mental health aspects to them. So it depends on the program, and we do it in those ways.
Now, I was looking at, like I said earlier, I was looking at the social media, and there was one video that really, grabbed my attention. It was a video produced for the campaign of stopping sexual exploitation. And in the video, there were two young men, and they were having a conversation, a confrontation, whatever you want to call it. One of them was trying to alter a girl's photo for, whether it was for to make a joke of her or to have some kind of revenge on her. And the other was arguing against that. I want to know, like, these kind of situations where a girl's photo is altered for whatever purposes, how prevalent is this? How prevalent is this kind of exploitation in Kurdistan?
Well, I'll start by telling you a little bit about the campaign, which we've actually been working on since last year. And the video you mentioned is actually one of three videos we've released so far. So and they each look at a slightly different aspect. So the campaign is looking at sexual exploitation, harassment, and abuse. Two of the videos focus on sexual exploitation, and the third one we released recently is on sexual harassment. It is prevalent in society. We see it. Our case managers deal with these cases on a regular basis. It is difficult to get accurate data because it's something that's very underreported because of the stigma that's attached to it. You know, there's a lot of victim shaming in Kurdistan, so it often makes it very, very hard for people who have suffered sexual exploitation, harassment, or abuse to actually come forward and report the issue. But we know from our work and from the cases we work on that it is a big issue, and it affects all stratas of Kurdish society. It's not just rich people, it's not just poor people, it affects everybody and across all locations.
No, and I'm sure, I mean, going back to my own teenagers when I was in Kurdistan, like I would always hear about stories like that. And sometimes you would hear some of the terrible, terrible ramifications that these things would have for the young women who were victims of it. What are, you know, you being in a position of, you know, being more expert about it than I am, what are some of the main ramifications to such a thing?
I mean, if we talk about altering and a person's photo and sharing it, there's really two sets of ramifications, those on the victims and those on the person who's done this, the perpetrator. So I'll start with the victim. You know, it could really cause social embarrassment and stigmatization. And most of the victims tend to be female, but that's not to say there aren't male victims of this as well. So I don't want to say that all the victims are women. But they often get stigmatized as a bad or immoral person, that, you know, the blame is automatically put on the girl, even though she hasn't done anything. Her photo has been manipulated, but it's because, you know, people might say, well, and she always dresses like that, so what's the difference? It's just a fake photo. It doesn't matter. But so aside from just the embarrassment and the stigmatization, her family very well may punish her. They may isolate her from her friends. They may restrict access to her phone or the internet. They may verbally and physically abuse her. She may have restriction on her movements, might not be allowed to go to school. And in the very worst case scenarios in these type of things, honor killings happen. And there is no honor in that type of killing, but that's how everybody refers to them. But that's the worst case scenario for the victim. So, you know, what people think might be funny, it's not. It has life-changing consequences. And I think what a lot of perpetrators don't realize is they are breaking the law. When you share a false, altered image, or even if you share a real image of somebody else without their consent, you're breaking the law. So, you know, and then some of them take it further. They try and extort money or sex from the victim, you know, to try and force them into doing other things. And so then you can be prosecuted under another law. You can be prosecuted under the anti-trafficking in persons law. And for sharing the photo illegally without their consent, you can be prosecuted under the Misuse of Telecommunications Act.
Wow. That last act that you mentioned, if I'm not wrong here, it came out a long time ago, very long time ago, before smartphones. It was about people using their phones to call up other people and prank call them, and, you know, sometimes things would get nasty. But, you know, it started out that way, but now it's kind of altering. But are the laws enough? Are they sufficient to prevent such exploitations?
You know, with any law, you can always improve it once you have a better understanding of the crimes that are happening. But the biggest problem is the implementation of the law. It's very difficult to have these laws implemented. And that's also partly due to people are very, you know, they're scared or shy to come forward and report these crimes, because of the social stigmas and taboos that we've talked about. It's a really big step for them to share what's happening to them. So getting a successful prosecution isn't easy, but the law is there. And, you know, we work with organizations such as DCVAL, which stands for the Directorate of Combating Violence Against Women and Families. It's a directorate belonging to the KRG. And they're working on these cases. They're working very hard. They're having training from us and from other NGOs to be more aware of the issues and how to implement the laws on this. They work very hard. They have a hotline, which we've also highlighted in the The video is 119, which people can call for free and in confidence to report the crimes if they want to.
Are there any cases that we can talk about? Any stories of such incidents?
I mean, I can't give you, you know, direct details about individual cases because obviously we have to be careful and protect our clients' identity. But I can give you some examples of the type of cases we've had. We've had cases where there's one type of scenario which is becoming common, which we refer to as the lover boy scenario, where often normally a girl is tricked into a relationship. They think they're having a genuine relationship with the man in question, and perhaps they go out with them, or perhaps they send some photos, not necessarily anything risque, but they could be intimate photos. And then it turns out that it's not a genuine relationship, and this man, this perpetrator, then turns around and tries to use these photos to either get money out of the girl or to extort sexual favors from her. You know, he'll threaten, I'm going to show these to your father, to your brothers, I'm going to put them on Facebook. And we have clients who have, you know, given all their money to these people to stop them from, to try in the hope that they won't share their photos online or with their families. Or the other type of one case we've had is where this guy said, you know, I want to marry you, but I can't, I don't have money, you know, we have to find a way to get money. And so the girl took money from her parents thinking that she was getting married. And of course he took the money and he ran. So this happens, and it happens widely. It's not uncommon. And especially with the way victims are often shamed, if they think that somebody's going to share their photo, they will desperately try and do anything to stop that photo being shared, real or fake. So, yes, it sadly, it's common.
Wow. And, you know, in such situations, the perpetrators are really taking advantage of the culture of shaming, of the culture of honor, to, you know, coax these girls or these young women, or even if it's young men, to do as they want. Now, and you know, a lot of people are really referring to that culture. They're pointing to that culture as a reason for why so much abuse happens. Does Seed work on changing things from a cultural point of view to change young people's minds, to help them understand better that this shouldn't be that way, or at least if something like this does happen, that the victim is not the person to blame?
You know, that's one of the aims we have behind this campaign that we're doing, is to educate people on the issues and to help people to understand that it's not the victim who has done wrong. If you're doing these crimes, it's the perpetrator, and the shame is on the perpetrator. It doesn't belong to the victim. They are the innocent party in this. And people who have this happen to them or who are at risk of it, they need our support. You know, we as a society have a duty to change. We're all agents of change. We can all do something. You know, we can all open our eyes. We can listen to the issues. If we have a friend or a loved one that this happens to, you know, you don't judge them and say, well, why were you talking to that person? You support them. You listen to their story. You help them. You know, it's not your place to judge them. They haven't done something wrong. As a society, we need to get better at doing that. And we really want, through the campaigns, that people see the issue and they begin to understand that these things are illegal, and it is the person doing it who is wrong, not the victim.
Of course. And now, you know, are you seeing more young people being attracted to this campaign? Are you seeing more young people trying to be involved with this movement to break those barriers of shame and honor when people are exploited?
We've noticed, as the campaign's built, that with each video we've released and with the messaging, that more people are interacting with the videos, sharing them. And also, as part of the campaign, we have been doing outreach work. We've been to some universities to do seminars on the issue. We've been doing some smaller group works in the community. And we have had a very positive reaction. Like, people know it's happening. They're aware of it. They've heard of these things happening in their community to other people, and they know it's an issue. And I think it's starting the conversation that's important, because then when it no longer becomes shameful to talk about it, you break that taboo of talking about the issue. It gives people who are at risk or who've had it happen to them, it makes it a little bit easier for them to come forward when they know there are people who won't judge them and will support them.
And, you know, in the past few years, we've really been seeing more and more stories, which is a testament to the progress that foundations like SEED are creating. Mm-hmm. One of the more infamous cases was the case of Sewa Qadir, the young woman who was burnt alive with her three children in Chamsamal. Now, from what I understand from the story is that she had gone to her family multiple times about the abusive husband who had who was the perpetrator behind these behind the fire that killed the family, and she had gone to her own family multiple times, but the family didn't want to help because they didn't want her getting a divorce and mm-hmm. besmirching that family honor. How can we change that? How can we make sure that women like Sewa aren't ignored or aren't shunned for the sake of for the sake of honor?
I mean, I can't speak to the specifics of that particular case, but we as an NGO and others can work to raise awareness on these issues, which we are trying to do with this campaign. And we will slowly help to change attitudes so that people begin to understand and see that shame does not rest with the victim. The shame belongs to the perpetrator. And then it's twofold. We can also work with the government to strengthen laws and policies that govern domestic issues. For instance, we're working with DCVAL, the Department for Combating Violence Against Women, on amendments to the domestic violence law, which will improve things like the mediation process for those who do start divorce proceedings. We also have to look at what alternatives are there for women in this situation where they don't have supportive families. You know, if there's not another safe option for shelter, for financial means to support herself and her children, then we as society, we're failing to support that woman. You know, if her family won't support her, we have to provide an alternative means so that she has an option to leave if she wants to. She doesn't feel obliged to stay in the situation.
And that's really one of the main issues, isn't it? Like, a lot of times, beyond the family, there really isn't much aid. Being the kind of culture that we have in Kurdistan, being a collective kind of culture where family depends on family. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also want to briefly talk about some of the psychological aspect of the work you do. Now, I think it was last week, I posted a tweet and I was saying that, constantly talking about tragedy, constantly listening to tragic stories about Kurdistan or about other places in the Middle East, it really takes a toll on you. And I think it was Chris Johannes from the SEED Foundation.
Yes.
He replied with a story about, I believe it's called vicarious trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to kind of touch upon that and see how the psychological aspect, beyond everything else that we talked about, plays a role in all of this.
Do you mean in terms of our staff or our clients?
Both the staff and the clients.
Okay, so a lot of the clients that we deal with are suffering from mental traumas, whether they've been victims of violence or psychological abuse. And we do offer comprehensive mental health support. We have group work. We have individual sessions. We work with an individual in themselves. We look at their wider situation. It may be that in order to support their mental health in a good way, we also have to do some work with their family so that they can meet in the middle and they can provide the right type of support to the person who's suffering, so they don't sort of stop their journey, as it were. We do group psychosocial support activities. We do a lot of those in the camps and in communities. And then for our staff, we recognize that, you know, they're dealing with clients who have suffered gross traumas. And that, as you said, is sort of, you can transfer trauma in that sense. So we're very conscious of that. And we have a well-being program at SEED where we you know, give our staff the chance to do things like meditation. We have group activities. There is mental health support there if they feel they would like to talk to somebody as well. We are conscious of the load on them, and we monitor that, and we support our staff with well-being activities. It is really important when you work in, you do this type of work, you need to have that support in place, and we're lucky at SEED that we're given it.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job. I also want to kind of refer back to the culture once more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our culture, it seems that getting psychological aid has a certain stigma attached to it. People either aren't willing to do it because of that stigma, or they're not willing to admit to doing it because of that stigma. Is that something that you come across when dealing with clients?
I mean, I'm personally not a mental health support worker, so I can only speak in very general terms. But yes, in this society, there is a stigma. It is changing. It is better. People are open to receiving help. I think a lot depends on how you explain what the processes are to them, how you build trust. One of the things we do is we work in the communities, we build trust. They see our work, they see our staff, they learn to trust us. So maybe people who aren't as receptive to getting help see other people benefiting from the help, and then they also engage in the process. But unfortunately, in Kurdish society and many other societies, there is sadly a stigma attached to mental health, and it really shouldn't be the case. People should feel, should be allowed to seek treatment freely and should feel comfortable to talk about their mental health.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was reading a book not too long ago, and one of the things that really highlighted, you know, multiple times was the fact that mental injuries or psychological injuries or psychological scars are similar to physical injuries. You know, you can't really go on and get up and do the same old thing after you've gone through a trauma, because you need to give yourself time to heal and give yourself the right tools to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any cases that I know perhaps you have to be confidential about and you can't speak to any details, but are there any cases that you can mention where psychological aid has rehabilitated a person after experiencing traumatic events?
Yes, we have a lot of successful cases. I mean, in the last year alone, we've given mental health support to over 200 clients. And it's not just a sort of short-term thing where we see them once or twice and that's it. They're, you know, they're given consistent support over 6 to 12 months. And also we've given psychosocial support group activities to over 600 people in the last year.
Wow.
One of the type of cases we've come across that I can tell you about is perhaps where we've got children who have experienced a trauma and they've internalized it and they can't reintegrate with their families. Perhaps they either withdraw, they don't speak, or they have violent tendencies, or they have problems reintegrating with their families. And then also you have to remember that perhaps the family also has suffered a trauma and they don't quite know how to support the child to help them reintegrate with the family. So what we do in those cases is we work with the child as an individual to support their mental health and give them techniques with which they can cope. And then also with the wider family to educate them about what the child is going through, to look and assess if they have a trauma that they also need to cope with, and to give them methods that they can use with the child so that eventually the child reintegrates and overcomes the problem, whether it's a lack of speaking or violent in groups or that. And we've had successful cases where that we had one family who the child was suffering so much that the family didn't feel they could take the child out with them. And so obviously it was affecting the family's social standing. They couldn't go and visit other relatives. They couldn't go to this. They couldn't do this and that because they felt they had to keep their child indoors because they were in their eyes, the child was acting up. But working with the child and the family, we were able to help them so that now the child has somewhat recovered. They behave better. They have coping mechanisms for when they feel anxiety, and the family have reintegrated back into the community and feel they can go out and take their child out with them again. So we have a lot of cases like that. So yes, the way at SEED we work with our mental health clients is that we don't just look at them as a single being with a single issue. We take a much wider 360 approach. We assess their whether it's an issue within their family, whether we can support them as a whole family as well, whether there's other physical matters that are physical health matters that are impacting them as well. So we look at them as a whole person, not just an issue. And so we treat them in a holistic manner to get the best results we can.
So this is all really, really positive. And it's really hopeful to see that this kind of work that is so necessary to Kurdish society is being done in Kurdish society, and we are seeing progress.
Yes, we are. You know, there's a lot of work still to do, but I've worked on and off in Kurdistan for over 10 years, and I see a huge change now from when I first started working here. And I see the engagement with what we're doing, and it really does give me hope that continued change and improvement can happen, because we all have that honors as a society. We all have a role to play, and we can all make a difference.
Of course. And you are playing a very big role in making that difference. So thank you for the work that you do. And thank you to the Seed Foundation for the work that they do, which is so, so, like I said, necessary to Kurdish society. And thank you for coming on the podcast and answering all my questions.
No, thank you very much for inviting us and giving me the chance to speak.
My pleasure.